Two of those, one may save enough food for three meals, that is the three meals for Shabbos, right? And that's what we call, just for everybody's reference in the Mishnah when we learn just Mishnah, the Tana Kama. The first opinion of an anonymous sage, or the position of the sages in the Mishnah, is called a Tana Kama. Tana being the sage of that era or that time period, Kama being first. Haraui la'adam la'adam, what's fit for people may be saved for people. Haraui li'vehema li'vehema, and what's fit for animals may be saved for the animals. So, if you have in mind, what are we really talking about? First of all, there's a halacha that's pointed out in Brachot on page 40 in the Gemara that says, on a Shabbos, a person is obligated to feed his or her animals before feeding oneself. Two, in terms of foodstuffs that I might have in my mind, ordered in my mind when it comes to the different kind of foods that my animals eat versus what humans, it might mean that I could save my barley and foodstuffs that I put aside for my animals to be fed on the Sabbath itself. And thusly, I've saved barley, because barley can always be food for animals, plus whatever foodstuffs I've set aside for them. In addition, I can save the stuff that I need for the people, vis-a-vis how many meals? Three meals, according to the sages, Tana Kama, the first opinion. Is it a radical kind of notion that one saves food for one's animals in the ancient world before one saves, or at least the halacha that's outlined in Brachot, is it radical that we feed them before ourselves? Somewhat yes, because we're saying take care of them before we take care of human needs, we take care of animal needs. On the other hand, one can understand the value of feeding one's animals and making sure that they're able to produce and remain alive and not be crippled under any kind of hunger pangs, especially if they have to do work Sunday morning, you know, vis-a-vis the Sabbath, especially if they're what creates our potential for livelihood. Animals churned the oil presses, animals did all kinds of work carrying that we couldn't possibly conceive of doing today without machinery. These are the kinds of chores around the quote-unquote ancient factory world. There are also the obvious ones of plowing the land and doing farming work that need to happen as well. All right, so they have in mind animals in this Mishnah about Shabbat. Ketzad, how do you do it? Or under what circumstances may one save enough food for three meals? I'm on 117b1. We're reviewing the Mishnah. Nafla deleka b'lele Shabbat, if a fire broke out on the Sabbath Eve, matzilin mazon shalosh su'dot, I can save three meals. Bishacharit, if the fire broke out in the morning before the meal, matzilin mazon shtei su'dot, he saves enough food for two meals. Bimincha mazon su'da achat, and if it broke out in the afternoon before the final meal, he may save enough food for one meal, since only one meal remains. Rabbi Yossi Omer, and Rabbi Yossi says, la'ola matzilin mazon shalosh su'dot. Doesn't matter, I don't need this kind of stop think. Is it shacharit, is it mincha, can I save one meal, can I save two? Rabbi Yossi says, forever, just go with the notion you could save enough food for the three meals of Shabbat at any time that there's a fire on Shabbat. You don't have to go through this kind of calculation. Calculus of saving meals, if you will. So, 117b2, right side of the page, more rules. Down at the bottom right-hand column if you're in the Schottenstein. And it's the Tanu Rabbanan if you're on the page in the Vilna. It is the Tanu Rabbanan in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th narrow lineup in the narrow part of the page. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught in a braita, Hitzil pat nikia, ein matzil pat hadara'a. If you save bread of fine flour enough for the three meals, he may not subsequently save bread made of inferior flour. So imagine now, fire breaks out. I'm running in, I got to save not only enough food, but for sure, what do I know about a Shabbos table? What do I need?
Challah.
I need challah. Let's, by the way, hold that thought and say that is, of course, what's going to come for us in terms of our thinking about what bread is under discussion. I'm going to discuss how that bread is not the bread under discussion in a minute, Bobby. But it's natural to think about the bread that we're eating, that we're talking about chalot here. So you see these nice, beautiful, twisted, braided challahs, and I need enough for three meals, so how many is that? How many challahs am I going to take out with me?
Six.
Six, because I know somewhere, somehow, I need two challahs for every meal I'm going to create on Shabbos. Let's just hold that thought. If I save that of fine flour, I can't save what's called pot hadra'a. Now, hadra'a is an interesting word, just by way of vocabulary of the Gemara. What's the issue here? The issue here, Rashi says, is like this. Lo yatzil pat hadra'a. Rashi is... This Rashi appears about the middle of the page, if you're in the Rashi with me. It's about at the bottom of Hagaot HaBach. Lo yatzil. Right? Doesn't save this bread of inferior quality, let's say, for right now. Pat Kiver shenitel hadra. That is a kind of rudimentary bread, coarse bread, that lost its beauty. That has no beauty. Hadara. Why is he saying it that way? Because of the actual vocabulary, hadra. Rashi's trying to think. Vocabulary. Rashi likes to do vocabulary exercises every now and then. He'll translate oftentimes to ancient, you know, French. The old French of his day. We have that lexicon of old French through Rashi, which scholars use. Here, he's trying to work out the actual notion of what this hadra'a is really all about. Lefi she'en erma k'shera, because it doesn't have a kind of revealing quality of goodness about it. Lomar pat hadra'a nochali. And by the way, you can't say, I'm going to plot this way. Lefisha ein ermak shedra lomar pat hadra'a nochali. You can't plot this way when it comes to this situation. Oh, I saved my fine bread. And now, you know what I was really thinking? I like that coarse stuff better. And I'm going to run into the house now and save the coarse stuff. Why do I teach that once you've saved fine flour bread, I can't go back and save the coarse stuff? Because a person is liable to create a situation where he says out loud kind of this, what we called last time, a legal fiction. That I really like that coarse bread better, therefore I'm going to run back in and get the coarse bread. In other words, I permit myself to go save this inferior quality bread because I create the notion that what I really like better is this bread of coarse and not so beautiful quality. It's kind of like the notion, remember we had an animal in a pit back at the time that we learned together? And if that animal was in a pit and there was suffering to it, I didn't need some situation to create some kind of situation where I said, oh, well, the animal, well, it won't be able to do its work, and therefore if I don't take it out of the pit, I don't need to make a story. If I had wine that broke on a roof and I was putting out vessels, and I had guests coming over, remember? And I needed the wine because I had all these guests coming over, I could have lots more places where I caught the wine. And at the moment where the barrel broke, if I make the quick decision to invite everybody over from my courtyard and say, oh, come as my guests, we're going to drink wine later, then I can put out kind of more vessels. Okay? The Gemara wanted us to avoid that kind of legal game. That was not okay. Here, the same concern comes. Don't create the legal game. Don't create the situation where you're going to put out this notion, where you're going to have this legal game going on, where you say, ah, done what the Mishnah said, I saved bread enough for the three meals. And by the way, I saved the fine flour bread. And now I go back and I say, oh, but because I like this one better, and that is part of my delight on the Sabbath, which is going to come up as the issue in a few paragraphs down the line, because that's part of my delight of Sabbath, I'm now going to be able to go back into the house and save this. Not even talking about danger here. Well, in a certain sense, they are talking about somewhat you're running back in being dangerous, and they're also talking about kind of making the excuse to go get this. They want you to avoid that situation here. Pat hadra'a. matzil pot nekiya. But if you did say that first, the pot hadra, the bread that is coarse and not so full of beauty, what can you do? You remember, oh, I have bread with fine flour back there, and I need to make my three meals. Fire hasn't totally caught yet. What can I do? Run back in and get it. Subsequently, you can save that fine flour. So that's the end of kind of that fine flour discussion. And you see that Sfat Emet, who's a Hasidic master, who's also a master of the Talmud, according to the note, says, he cites evidence to prove that this is true, even according to the rabbis, who in the case of the barrel, forbid using a subterfuge. That was the word that was used in the translation, the subterfuge, the legal fiction, the story, in order to achieve that. Even the rabbis who would say that you're making the quick invitation for more people to come drink your wine allows you to create the different the space of putting different vessels in order to gather all that wine again. Even they who would say, don't do that shtick, they would allow someone to go back after they took the coarse bread but wanted to go find the fine flour bread. Why? So let's. That's why I'm kind of pausing before we get to the for which day and for what on the calendar. Why would they allow someone to go back and get the fine flour bread? If you've already got this one, you're worried about A, people running into a fire, and B, you have other things to consider in terms of what you save. By the way, the whole discussion started with text. And
maybe you make a kiddush on the pot of
rav. Okay.
It's more beautiful.
Or you make the kiddush on the what?
Motzi.
You're going to make it on the ugly one?
No, on the new, on the good one.
Oh, so that's pot. That's not the hadra'ah. The hadra'ah is the ugly one.
Ironic.
The pot nikiyah is the fine one. So you're saying, go get that one because that's the one you have to break bread on. Right? So that could be that the rabbis were pushing us to always have pot nikiyah, fine floured bread, and to have very, very fine bread for this Shabbat meal.
But am I understanding the situation correctly? I'm understanding this to be a subterfuge where the person intentionally is getting the coarse bread first so that he can run back in to get the fine.
Okay, so did it actually say that the person had that kind of kavanah?
No, definitely.
That's one direction. One direction to go is to say, I've created the subterfuge, meaning I am actually creating the scenario lechatchila from the get-go that I go first get the rough coarse bread, the bread that's not so fine and not great for Shabbos. Why? Because I want to eat that Sunday.
Well, that's even a different situation.
No, but I'm adding. But I'm adding. Because it's important for the next statement of the Gemara that we add. One of the thought reasons why you have the whole situation here to begin with is because how much food am I really allowed to take? And for what day am I talking about? So that's part of this narrative. Whether or not I've used it, like, from the get-go, though, for eating that bread on the Sabbath day as part of my meals, and now I go and get the other fine bread in order to make my motzi, but I'm going to eat this one during with my soup, chillin', whatever it is. So A, it could be that they're avoiding it from the get-go situation, and B, it could be that they're still trying to avoid it from the B'day Avad situation, from the after-the-fact situation.
Is there any limit to the ugly bread? No.
Doesn't sound like it.
Right, so in essence, it's an opportunity to have a whole lot more.
Yeah.
To bring out a whole lot more,
right.
Whereas we can reasonably assume there's a limit of what's going to be available with the beautiful bread.
Reasonably assume, because how much pot nikiyah can you really have?
Right, so this is an opportunity.
Right. So it's, in other words, and it goes against the spirit of the Mishnah in that way.
Right.
Because the Mishnah is kind of defining how many meals worth of stuff that I could really take out.
I have a question in regards to the Mishnah about the Behema. The Ochel Abura Behema. And that means, I know that at that time they didn't raise the cows in the Chaser. Maybe chickens. But chicken is not the Behema. So
they really didn't have cows, by the way.
They didn't have cows at that time?
They really had goats. Goats and sheep.
Goats is not a behema. Para is a behema.
No, but in this... I mean, here we're talking about goats, sheep.
So even if goats, I think they used to have a refet, so to speak. So this means the rabbi allowed them to save from a completely different domain.
Yeah. So let me put it to you this way. They didn't have dairy cows per se. Their dairy didn't come from cows. They did have oxen.
They had some type of
behemah in your sense of the word that they had. The word behemah generally means beasts, but in this case, in the Gemara, Ron is right, probably does refer to the oxen and the female, what do you call the steer at that time? It's a cow, but it's not a dairy cow.
It's not
your Holstein version. So, no, it has to do with the fact that Ron's asking about the Mishnah. So, is the food we're talking about saving in the domain that's other than your house?
Right.
Within the notion of having a storage of food, right, we're probably here not talking about major, you know, big farm communities. We're talking about the kind of behema animal life that was in the chatzer. Because we're talking about houses that are connected to each other and houses that catch on fire on Shabbat.
Maybe little goats and chickens.
Right. Food for your animals. Now, I want to come back to what we were saying before about what bread we envision. Right? So anybody here, not by way of being too revealing, right? Anybody here not use challah if they're going to make a Shabbat meal? Anybody have a different kind of fine flour bread that they prefer?
Because we're gluten-free, make sure to make all of this at least more than half oat flour. But it's not what you would all consider oat flour.
Okay, so there's a version of bread even around our table that's not particularly the, you know, nice yellow egg challah. Some people use water challah. It looks like the egg challah.
Pizza. As long as it's round enough. As long as it's not broken.
Okay, so pizza.
They didn't have challah.
Okay, so you're right. In the Middle East particularly, even when they had challah in Europe, they didn't have challah in the Middle East. So I want to just give you a little bit of the history that I researched for us this sugya in terms of the mentioning of bread. A couple of different sources came off the shelf, a couple of sources that I really love. So food history in and of itself is interesting. There's some secular cookbooks that go through and have generalized food history.
I think
and
we had a very good research book when we did our food show by Marx, is his name, and it's an encyclopedia of Jews and food, and I think we may have it someplace on the shelf, but in any rate, it's a wonderful source.
If you spy it, I'd love to see it.
I'll look for it. Yeah.
If you spy it, I'd love to see it. So, the first place that I want to take us to is this book by Oded Schwartz. It's called In Search of Plenty. It's a history of Jewish food, and it has more than 100 recipes in it. I love books that combine the two. I think that they're very powerful. He has a section on bread. Let me read from it. Grain was used not only for cooking, but also to make the most popular and convenient staple, bread. In God's curse on Adam for disobeying his orders, bread is used as a metaphor for food and life. The verse in this context defined from the beginning the attitude of Jewish people towards their food. Life, therefore, bread carries with it the guilt of the original rebellion against the rule of God. I'm not sure that it's carried that for me. Just by way of putting that out there. I'm not sure that there's... That bread carries with it the guilt associated. That the verse in this context defined from the beginning the attitude of Jewish people towards their food. Life... Therefore, bread carries with it the guilt of the original rebellion against the rule of God. So that's not typical for Midrash, and shows you that you could be very interpretive, right? In especially through modernity, it's not the typical way we associate. However, right? Well, however,
you can have an opinion.
When he says the Jewish people,
right?
Well, he says the Jewish people, and he's a decent researcher. He's got lots of good studies that others who have studied food and food history and Jewish attitudes towards food have used. But meanwhile, he does say something.
Well, it's analogous to the Christians' view about Garden of Eden and their attitude towards
sin. Maybe original sin.
Original sin. So I mean, you can understand the thought process whether you agree with it or not. Can understand how it got there.
Now, he does cite the following. He says, the origin of bread baking is unclear. The most logical chain of events is that man discovered that a paste made from the mixture of roughly broken grain and water is more palatable if the paste is left for a while for the grain to absorb water and become more moist. The next step was the discovery that the paste could be dried in the sun, which preserves it, then that toasting the grain paste on a hot stone gave a quicker, better result and produced a smell, which is one of the most appetizing known. The bread the patriarchs baked was probably made from an unleavened mixture of pounded grain, water, and probably, although there's no concrete evidence, salt. The resulting dough was kneaded, probably left to rest for a while, and then shaped. Shaping was done by nimbly stretching the flattening the dough with circular, clapping hand motions. The dough was then baked and usually eaten hot. The thin chapati-like breads were probably baked on flat, heated stones. The stones were later replaced by concave clay utensils with holes in them. The bread was thrown into the heated surface, which was suspended above burning embers. It was baked quickly on one side, turned over, and baked on the other. A metal version of this utensil is still used in India and by Bedouin, if you go to the Sinai with them. And it's
And by Nagila, the restaurant,
which I was just going to say, I passed by the other day and was going to ask them, maybe we could borrow that one time to have a... So it really makes beautiful pizza. Bread was of enormous importance to the Egyptians. They were referred to in Greek writings as bread eaters. Bread effigies were used by the poor as sacrifices, and bread also had sexual overtones. The Egyptians made it in the shape of a phallus, an association which was suggested by the swelling, rising motion of the dough. These pagan and sexual associations might be the reason for the ambiguity of the Bible about yeast. This is reflected in the Hebrew idiom, leaven in the dough, which has a dual meaning. On one hand, the idiom means positive, active, and lively, and on the other, it can mean an evil nature and the cause of decay. Leavened bread was forbidden for sacrifice as atonement, but it was allowed for Thanksgiving. And that's true, and it comes out through sources throughout the centuries in Jewish sources, that leavening and chametz is about the powerful ego and yetzer hara, the evil inclination, taking over and has that association with it, and that's why we get to a dough that's unleavened for Pesach.
And can I just add, Sunday night we're all going to be here to listen to Natalie Freeman talk about Bread Givers, which is a book written in 1910 about Jewish immigrants, and Natalie wrote her dissertation on that subject matter, but it's bread givers. It's fascinating to see how it comes through.
The Bible gives breads descriptive names which represent their shape, ingredients, or methods of making. The simple everyday bread was called matzah, which probably means that the bread was not leavened. The Bible distinguishes between four types of matzah. Challah matzah, which was made from a special quality of flour, matzah belula, which was probably the same mixture combined with oil, rakik matzah, which describes the bread as being very thin, and we use the rakik for a cracker today in modern Hebrew, and uga matzah, or round bread, bready, and today uga is the word for cake in modern Hebrew. So oil was probably the ingredient that was added, if there was anything added at all. Salt, again, he's put into question by way of whether or not it was part of the dough recipe. That's Oded Schwartz's piece. John Cooper did a social history of Jewish food. And really nicely researched book. I opened to the page of the herring. See, you can open to any page and it's interesting, but I'm not going to read about that. Challah. David Katz has put forward a fruitful hypothesis that the Yiddish language and culture originated in southern Germany and beyond, not in the Rhineland. Okay, so here we have, you know, the Yiddish culture introduced. In the East, Oriental Jews still retain the traditional round shape of bread for the Sabbath loaf, the challah. So, what does that mean? There was a traditional Sabbath loaf that was round, somewhat doughy, not all the way crisp, that in many circles, if you would have kept that grain aside and cooked it only up to 18 minutes, could have even passed for matzah. Because really all matzah is dough and water. Guarded dough that's cooked just right without any kind of possibility that there could be any water left to make any of the flour into hummus. But this doughier bread that was round, which maybe had a pocket, maybe didn't, depending on the area that you were from in the world, because different people had different kind of experience with making these round cakes. That was the bread that we talk about when we're talking about the fine flour bread of our Mishnah. They didn't know about eggs, for sure, and egg challah in terms of making bread. They used to have ovens. For instance, he goes to some social history here. The Jews of Kurdistan baked only plain loaves of bread that were sprinkled with sesame seed, and the Shiraz in Iran, a diaspora community from the time of the Talmud, made a special loaf for the Sabbath. There was a widespread distribution of the custom of baking fresh loaves of bread on Friday among disparate Jewish communities that were round, somewhat doughy, and baked inside an oven like in rabbinic commentaries. The ovens were barrel or dips or made out of bricks, and then you would throw the bread onto the sides. And there was a special implement, a breadboard of sorts, that you used to take those quote-unquote loaves off. Don't think of loaf as being, you know, like the sandwich bread that has the slices, but the loaves being these round circles. Now, in terms of challah, a late 15th century work by a pupil of the renowned Austrian rabbi Isserlin said the following: on every Sabbath eve, they made for him three fine challot, a bread kneaded with eggs, oil, and a little water. The middle-sized challah he put at night in the middle of the tablecloth, and under the challah was a big loaf which was complete, although it was black, and a small roll of fine flour to differentiate between the egg bread and the one with flour. The discussion there goes on, and as a matter of fact, people don't know whether or not using eggs defines a loaf of bread as what we call in halachic codes pat habala kisni. Somehow there's an additive within the bread that would make it ineligible for saying hamotzi over it, and would require us to say, like we would over a pastry, borei mine mizonot, and not hamotzi lechem in haaretz. However, the 16th century Rabbi Isserles, following the same tradition, referred to the Sabbath bread that was baked on a Friday under the name of lachamim, loaves of bread, while a similar designation was used in the early 19th century by the author of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the shortened version of the authoritative Code of Jewish Law. With the migration of German Jews eastward, the use of plated loaves for the Sabbath's bread spread slowly, first into Poland and then into Lithuania. Challah in Poland was often prepared with sugar and had a sweet taste. But this was a mid or late 19th century innovation. While the berches were made with no sugar or almost no sugar, despite assertions to the contrary, braided challot known as kitkis, anybody know that term? It's new for me in this study. As well as ordinary challot were common in Lithuania in the period between the two world wars. Earlier, however, the term kitka was reserved to describe twisted challot only baked in the small towns of Lithuania for the festivals of Tabernacle, Shavuot, and Purim, whereas plain challot were baked for the Sabbath, without the additions. Even in Poland in the 19th century, Jews often baked plain challot. If berches was a medieval term, we would have expected it to have passed into Eastern Yiddish, instead of which the word challah and a variety of other terms were used to describe the Sabbath bread. Again, there are indications in the rabbinic sources of Jews in medieval Spain and England preferring to eat hot non-Jewish bread on the Sabbath rather than stale Jewish baked bread. Right? That's patla goyim, the bread of other nations. Mind you, that's a whole discussion within this matter too that could arise. Evidence as that as yet a special Sabbath loaf had not evolved. So, in other words, this whole notion of challah is a very up to the middle of the two world wars, not a construct within, you know, kind of the discussion of which bread you bless over for Friday night that we have according to this study of the social history of bread.
So what are the interpretations of the show bread in the temple?
So the question is, what are the interpretations of the showbread? What kind of bread were they? Were they the challot that we like to think of again? Like, you know, braided loaves sitting beautifully with that nice egg glaze, right? Nothing of the sort.
The images that I've seen, like medieval, they look like pizza.
Right. They are these round, like discs of matzot. Matzot not being matzah, as in the crunchy manischewitz holes in them with the little tool kind of bread, but these matzot, these breads. And the show breads, interestingly enough, create one kind of tradition that is referred to in the halachic sources. And in just another minute, we're going to get to a part of the Gemara, because I want to go back to it before we continue it along. We're going to get to the discussion of what kind of loaves you need, and then I'm going to share with you how the showbreads played into the thinking of the Sabbath bread discussion and what you need.
The Egyptian bread wasn't long, only round. It was oblong. We can go see it in the models. So we know that they had different shapes.
I'm sure there were different shapes by way of all the cultures,
we can physically
depending on the kind of oven you had and depending on how you threw it on the walls.
Yeah, from a character's model.
All right, so let's continue along a little bit more, and then we'll get back to some of this bread. So, okay, the Gemara shifts to this, for a minute for what days you can save things for. In case you were thinking that someone was going back and grabbing more of the food items for different days. So it says, I'm on 117b3 now, on the left side if you're following the, in the Hebrew English. U'matzilin miyom ha-kippurim le-shabbat, and you may save food on Yom Kippur for the Sabbath. So if Yom Kippur falls on a Friday and the fire breaks out, then you can go save it for the Sabbath. Avalog nishabbat le-yom ha-kippurim, but not on the Sabbath for Yom Kippur if Yom Kippur falls on a Sunday. Ve'ein tzarich lomar mishabbat le-yontif, and needless to say, not on the Sabbath for Yontif. Why? Because if Yontif's going to start, what can I do on Yontif? I can cook, so long as I have a burning fire. So I have ochel nefesh. V'lomi Shabbat l'Shabbat haba'ah. And of course not from one Shabbos to the next. I can't justify that. Because A, I don't have anywhere really to store it in the ancient world except for jars that I need to seal entirely, and have that whole process I can't do right away. And B, I can cook during the week. Simply put. Okay? Now.
So what about the behemot? Are we allowed to take all my
food? We're talking about humans. We haven't had more discussion on it. That's basically what we can say at this point. The Gemara ultimately talks about now different types of peril that you're going to have with bread. Perilous situations. You know, almost a disaster, as we say. Kitchen disasters. Tana Rabbanan. We have a brayta. The rabbis taught, Shachach pat batanur. Oh, one forgot bread baking in an oven. Now again, those ovens are, you know, with walls, and I have to ultimately throw the dough on, and I'm going to take them out. V'kidesh alav hayom. And Shabbos started. Now it's interesting, nusach here, kidesh alav hayom. In other words, you didn't make kiddush and start Shabbos, but the day got holy on you. In other words, Shabbat really started. In other words, you know, based on the tradition of the rabbi's law, it would be asur, forbidden, to really deal with those loaves in the oven at this point.
But they had been put in before.
Doesn't matter. When it comes to the malacha of Shabbat, I can't go into my oven, take things out if it's the full fire. I might stoke the fire. I can't really do baking and cooking. It's not like I have it on the blech. It's not like I have it on the warmer. This is real, like in the oven. Matzilin mazon shalosh sudot. Oh, but there I can save 3 meals worth of food, the bread. Va'omer la'acherim, and he can say to others, bo v'hitzilu lechem, come and save for yourselves whatever you need, right? Now, why can I say to others, because I have, maybe I put in all this dough. I had extra amounts of dough that I created. In some shared courtyards, like our drawing here, I had a communal oven. It was a big enough oven that I could actually walk in. Remember, we had a story about someone who walked into an oven in Sanhedrin. There were ovens in which people could literally fit themselves in the front part of it, and then there would be a room where things are baking. So this could be a situation where you have an oven that's that big, and there's extra dough that I made, and I have enough bread in there that was going to be more, right? And I was going to have some for Shabbos, and I was going to have some for other times, because before Shabbos I could bake as much as I wanted to. So Sunday I didn't want to bake again. So maybe for a day I could put it in the jar and put a sealed top on it. But I could say to others, come get this bread. I don't want it to go to waste. Uchashehu rodeh lo yirdeh b'mirdeh elo b'sakin. But when he actually takes the bread out of the oven, he's not going to do it with the tool called a mirdeh. That's a baker's paddle. So the closest thing I could possibly see us relating to in that vein is the pizza oven, the implement that the guy who makes the pizzas uses. It was a little bit different, though. Probably not as wide as today's pizzas are wide, and tapered on the sides, almost like the ends were, they're not sharp like a blade, but in the reality you needed something to be able to kind of get underneath that outside rim of the pizza, and then quickly take it off and put it back so that it's balanced there. So, but you don't use that if this situation arises. What do you use? You use a knife. Now, what kind of knives did they have in those times? Interesting whole social history of knives and knife making and what kind of knives there were. And different metals, of course, were around. Iron was already well known. There were actually iron knives. Bronze was well known. You had, not tempered metals in the same way that you have later on in blade making with weapons. But what's that? You have daggers. Oftentimes, daggers are made out of more rudimentary metals, even though, right, for use within work culture, as opposed to fancy culture. You might have had some weapons, though, really forged weapons, and blacksmiths were good at forging those. And maybe some of those were used within kitchens. You for sure could, though, use a knife and not the baker's board if the situation arose that you had a fire. And the Gemara asks, Ini? I love that kind of challenge of the Gemara. Ini? Is that so? In other words, is that the case? Do you want to rethink that? V'ha tana devei Rabbi Yishmael, it was taught in the academy, Rabbi Yishmael, lo tase chol malacha. You can't transgress. You can't violate any of the central principles of the laws the rabbis established, the main categories of work that you may not do on the Sabbath. And taking out bread and being in that oven baking bread, that's a problem. That's a malacha, according to this teaching where it is now. In other words, the assumption here of this teaching is, how can you possibly permit that? You're breaking Shabbat. Any which way. Baking board or with a knife. Yatsa tikiyat shofar or rid yata pacha hi chochma ve'ena malacha. But excluded, right? Excluded is the blowing of the shofar or the removal of the bread. So so this is how the whole limud goes. That was the assumption before, that you might be saying that he's breaking a malacha. So now the whole teaching of Rabbi Yishmael. Ini, really? He has to move from what? A breadboard to a knife? Really, Rabbi Yishmael is challenging the whole principle that I have to do anything differently. Because I'm not defining it as a malacha, Rabbi Yishmael is saying. You might have thought there was some issue with doing the malacha, and he had to use a knife as opposed to a board. Why might you have thought that? Because if I do something with a bit of a change, called a shinui, maybe I could still do it, even if it's Shabbat, and I have to do it. This is a principle that's going to extend itself out throughout Shabbat laws, that if I do something with a bit of a change, which is called shinui, I can accomplish what I want to accomplish anyway. So let's say that, you know, a light's left on in somebody's house who's observing Shabbat these days. What happens? If I don't have someone who's under 5 years old or under 3 years old around and lift them up and tell them, it would be really nice if it was dark. You maybe take your pinky and you stand by the light and you go, because it's a shinui. Do I do that during the week to turn my lights on and off? Do I use that? No. I never go like this to turn a light off and on. I just flick it. But since I made this little change, I might say that legally I'm somehow able to do this. There are those people who would leave it on and not do that at all, right? But a shinui has been the solution. You know, somebody's not where they want to go and there's no Eruv and they're carrying a bag, and so, you know, they'll skip three and then jump one. Skip three, jump one. They'll walk a different way. Because that's not like really carrying the same way as I would carry something during the week. Is it a, what was the word that the, is it talking about subterfuge, or is it talking about, as we talked about before, a holy game, and these are all kinds of things that you can figure out for yourselves. Here, Rabbi Yishmael is saying, you made the change from breadboard to knife. You didn't need to do that. Why? Because blowing the shofar and taking bread out of the oven is not a matter of malacha. It's not a matter of a major category of work that's going to be violated on the Sabbath. It's a wisdom, it's know-how, that what? Ain't a malacha. It's not an area of law that you're going to break. Kama de'efshar l'shanuye mashninan. As much as it's possible to deviate from the norm, you deviate, though, the Gemara answers. You say, Sabbath came, here's the answer the Gemara gives. You may not put it in that category. You may not think you're breaking a malacha. You may think it's a chokhmah. You know what? Change. Change up. Because it's Shabbat. And instead of taking it out with the breadboard, why don't you make the change and take it out with the knife? That creates, in essence, Sabbath culture. That creates Sabbath consciousness.
Well, we don't have to use different silverware.
No.
I mean, the reason they want you to switch a paddle to a knife but not have to use different silver is it because there's some nature of labor? Or, I mean, I was trying to figure out why they would, in the first place, think that you'd have to.
They need to justify to save food for the week, basically. So they find a way. They were magicians.
No, because this is questionable. You're, in effect, you're opening your oven to take something out of it.
Yeah, so it's got that's some aspect that's, yeah.
Their subterfuge is calling it an art. I mean, granted, the food is cooked. So it's not still cooking, but...
Yeah, but you could argue that they needed that extra time that ran into shops to finish cooking it.
That's different.
And so it's yet another level of subterfuge.
Yeah. Well, but gosh, that's...
They were running late, and they put it in late. Right. Because, I mean, they know how long it takes to cook bread.
The whole point for the rabbis here, the whole point is to make a change. So let me just tonally in my head, here's how the conversation unfolds again. Let me run through it just one more way. The rabbis say in one brayta, you can save enough for three meals, and you can tell others come and save. Right? When you remove the bread in this situation, don't use the regular paddle. Use a knife. Whatever that instrument is, it's a change in instrument. You make a change, because that's what we're going to do. Comes along the Gemara and says, really, is that so? Because what Yishmael says, the Torah states don't do any labor, and it really excludes from any of those categories. In other words, it's not really biblically prohibited to make a tikiyah shofar, and it's not really biblically prohibited to take out bread.
The
Gemara, yeah, but, you know, in other words, to take it out of the oven right now, I could make my double portion available to me by having a double portion in my oven. And since it's not biblically prohibited to take bread out of an oven, particularly, That's Rabbi Yishmael's kind of thought here. But the Gemara comes back and says, as much as you can make a change to create Sabbath culture and to do this in a different way, then you're going to do it. So here, I make the change in terms of this aspect, back to the difference between the meal and the silver cutlery and the here. This act of being in the fire and baking, that I'm not going to really do. It sounds like the one piece here that, if I was looking at this further in texts, I might expect a discussion. Was the bread more than 60% done? Was the bread more than 80% done? Or am I waiting for it to bake? And if I had to wait for it to bake, it might be a little different. And here it sounds like you just need to get it out of the oven.
Yeah, it sounds like it was already
cooked. Why did everybody allow all these changes and rules? They could have another rule that says if somebody has a fire in his house, we can have a new mitzvah of Achnasat Orchim, and all those people who suffer the fire will eat in another place.
Yeah, simply for the reasons we've talked about before, that we have a certain narrative law developing that creates a connection for us to Torah, to verses, to the way we create a culture and what the rabbis are legislating. And so the what ifs, in Talmudic discussions, you can continue asking what ifs. For the rabbis, it is, with this is how we work because our Torah inspires us to see it this way. So we kind of give ourselves over to that and know that we're creating a culture that's Torah-based and that has rabbinic authority and that rabbinic law is as powerful as Torah pshat sometimes. Torah's simple sense of what Torah says. So ultimately, the Gemara is going to now move to a place to discuss the meals, and that's where we're going to get back to the bread. But before we do, I want to point out one piece that Rashi's grandchildren discuss. The Tosafot are on the right side of the page in this case because we're on a page where there's Rashi in the gutter on the left and the Tosafot are on the right. And it's just an interesting thing. V'hatana de Beit Rabbi Yishmael is the Tosafot I'm going to deal with. What were they really saying in Rabbi Yishmael's Beit HaMidrash? What was Rabbi Yishmael's teaching really all about? How do I deal with this discussion? How do I understand his approach to saying something is or is not malacha on Shabbos? Something is a major category of work. So, v'hatan at the Beit Rabbi Yishmael, kol melechet avodah lo tasu. All manner of work you shall not do. Ve'im taimar, v'ame mai tikra dechol melechet avodah dichtiv gabe yantiv ha'afilu b'Shabbos dichtiv lo tasu malachas. Okay? Going back. If you're going to tell me that you're going to bring me a verse about Yontif that says the following, the Chol Melechet Avoda Lo Ta'asu, it says Chol Melechet Avoda. It has the word all manners of work. Melechet Avoda. Another word. Not just Malacha, which means work in and of itself, and it's one of the major categories of what the rabbis will say we don't do on Shabbat. But it says Melechet Avoda. If you're going to tell me that you have for Yontif this notion that there's a malacha and an avodah, and by Shabbat, dichtiv lo ta'aseh malacha, but by Shabbat, it only says the word, don't do a malacha. And so I have an extra word, malechet avodah, when it comes to Yontif, days of Yontif. Which are we talking about? Pesach, Shavuot, days we have on the calendar that are called Yontif days. But locative avoda, hatam. Hatam, locative avoda. And there, it doesn't really say avoda, the word avoda, when it comes to the Sabbath. Share litkoa velirdots mean, and it says hatorah here. I believe what they're saying is that it's Torahitic law then, that what can you do? Since, you might say to me, since I don't find the word avodah, and I only find the word malacha with Shabbat, I might think that is permitting me the ability to take bread out of the oven and to sound the shofar. Oh, because a word missing within a verse says something. Kedemashma hacha de ashabat maite lau ferish Rabbeinu Shmuel. The garas kol malacha lo ta'asu. The Rashba mefaresh de la olam mikol malacha avoda imait tikiya veridia. V'shabbat yalfinan miyom tov. De'ein bein yom tov v'shabbat. Ela ochal nefesh. So says the following. Tosafot work like this. You might bring me, based on what this Gemara is saying that Rabbi Yishmael was thinking about, with the blowing of the shofar and pulling bread out of the oven. You might bring me the notion that he's understanding being able, that he's understanding two verses of the Torah as teaching two different things. The verse about Yontif, he's saying those things might be completely forbidden, and, but we know that taking bread out of the oven isn't, by the way, because it also says you can cook ochel nefesh, and there was a specific verse about what you could cook and what you couldn't cook, and therefore I would have no concerns about that. You might say, though, that since there's a verse that might look like it's forbidding it, and a verse that then permits it for yuntas, that I have a discussion regarding cooking on yuntiv that's very clear and specific. And since the verse for Shabbat says don't do malacha without the word avodah, and doesn't have any kind of, let's say, qualifying verse to come around and teach me anything more about it. And therefore I have to see shofar and taking bread out of the oven as what? Simply malacha that would be forbidden, because I can't have any other category to define it. I don't have an extra word like avodah or chachma even, because he says he calls them wisdoms over in his original teaching, Rabbi Yishmael. But the Torah doesn't give another word over there in Shabbat. It's not avodah, it's not chokma. You might say that you have to forbid them or permit them by way of some other understanding that you have of what those areas of work are about. But the reality is that you don't need to go through that interpretive process. Because we learn about Shabbat from Yontif. And if, on Yontif, I can do these things from Ochel Nefesh, I can do, well, let's say, taking bread out from the fact that I have Ochel Nefesh, that I'm allowed to cook, I have no verse that says that for the Sabbath, qualifying my taking things out of the oven. It's not any other thing other than a malacha, and therefore, for the Sabbath, I have to rule that it's forbidden. When it comes to Tikiyat HaShofar, and Rabbi Yishmael's thinking about that, right? Because what do we say about the sounding of the shofar on the Sabbath? We don't do it, right? So again, I have no qualifying word for it. I really don't understand, in essence, what Tosfos is saying, how Rabbi Yishmael is qualifying that as a chokhma. I don't have the word even avodah in the Torah verses, and therefore I simply learned that what's asur in the one place, what's forbidden in the one place, has to be forbidden in another. And I don't really have the possibility to make this permissible, and thusly what? I forbid it. In other words, when Rabbi Yishmael purports that these things are not major categories of work that the Torah forbids, he says that perhaps we could permit them with changes. Well, taking out the bread for yontif was permitted, because it says in Torah ultimately that you have the ability to cook. By the way, you still want to make some change on Shabbat, and by the way, with cooking on yontif, what's the thing I need always to think about? That the fire is already there. I'm going to learn on Shabbat nothing specific about making anything permissible that I might have a reason to forbid, because I ultimately have the word malacha, and I don't want to break malachot. Later on, the rabbis will make forbidden the blowing of the shofar. They're concerned not whether or not the action itself is a chokhmah or not. It's a skill. They're concerned that one might break a malacha, particularly that of carrying.
So this is the idea of fences, right?
Right.
So these are
so.
Does the shofar have other purposes then? Do they use something similar or a shofar to gather the community or to bring the cattle in or something?
Well, there were other times that the shofar was used. I'm not sure what they would do vis-a-vis using it for any kind of animal.
Was it associated with work?
Hurting or has the drill. I can't answer exactly. I don't exactly know the social history of shofarot and their use within community, but it's a good question.
But there's a very narrow interpretation of making the Mishkan, and because I've always been confused to that, because I see one interpretation as what's prohibited is what was done to make the Mishkan, but then obviously there are a lot of things that have nothing to do with making the Mishkan that we don't do on Shabbat.
Barry's talking about the 39 major categories of work that the rabbis define as those working categories that we don't transgress or we don't violate on the Sabbath. And loosely they're connected back to the work of the Mishkan. That's really a midrashic understanding. And the categorical definitions of the work of the Mishkan is one way to understand the rabbis making those 39 malachot, but there's room to understand their legislation in deeper terms, in terms of simply the legislation that they ought to create a way to shmor et haShabbat, to keep Shabbat.
So if you live in a world where you're allowed to make fences, then you can have a very narrow core and lots of fences. Or you can define everything as core and say you have no fences.
That kind of gets back to what Ron was saying about, you know, whether or not they can ask this type of question or that type as well, said in a way that their parlance for sure wants to help people engage Torah. How much of a fence do I need? You know, that was the debate probably in the reason, and one of the reasons why at the outset of Avot, which is a later tractate, they said to people, and they kind of marketed the idea, building fences is part and parcel of this project. It's part of what the Masoret, the tradition being passed down generation to generation, has been all about. Because remember, the first Mishnah in Avot says Moses gave it to Joshua, and Joshua gave it to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and by the time you're done with that first Mishnah and the tradition coming down, it says that you have to raise many students and that it's good to make fences around the Torah. So that's a central concept of the rabbis.
The integration of Torah study, we got a lot of ideas, so they tried to sensitive.
Okay, so we must get to this last piece before the day ends, the night ends. So let's go back into the Gemara here, right side, because now we're going to get to the meals. Amar Rav Chista. Rav Chista said, La'olam yashkim adam lahotza'at Shabbat. A man should always rise early on Friday morning to tend to the expenditures and to get your house in order for the Sabbath. Shene'emar, V'haya b'yom ha'shishi v'haychinu et asher yaviu. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare that which they bring. La'altar. And this applies immediately. So, in other words, get up early, get your Shabbos kinyah, get your Shabbos purchasing done, make some order in your world for Shabbat that cometh. Henry, you had something before, sorry.
No, I had to look up why you couldn't blow the shofar on Shabbos on Rosh Hashanah, and there was quickly, you know, and you Google it, you find out right away that the Talmudic explanation was that a person not sufficiently knowledgeable would try to blow the shofar on Shabbat and not know how to do it and carry the shofar in order to an expert to learn, and because he might do that, that's basic reason for not
blowing.
And then they go on to say, but would you really deprive people of the pleasure of hearing the shofar on Shabbat? Well, Shabbat itself is a pleasure that makes up for it. So anyway,
that right, right. That is a major part of the discussion. Richard,
you brought something up this last holidays. Should we really leave this? Should we leave the shofar at the bima? Or can be carried up, because you mentioned something that to me I was confused.
That was only about Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, we wouldn't carry the shofar, just like we wouldn't carry the shofar on a Shabbos. You leave it in the place that you need it for right after the service, so that you wouldn't carry it. Like, let's say, if you were coming to shul, and you wouldn't want it in your talis bag. So, in the future, if you want to do that mitzvah in a more, you know, in a more rabbinic way, you would place your shofar in the table, already, in the shul, and you yourself, walking back and forth, wouldn't take it with you. So now that...
If you get up there and it's not there.
Well, I think that we're not concerned. It's like...
I wish I had a shofar over here.
You know what? I mean, there's a little bit about preparing, putting something in a place, and not worrying about it that goes along with being part of a community. That's, you know, they do a lot of that expectation of us. That we not keep things like that. That we have things in the shul or there ready for us for Shabbat.
The Eruv has any...
No, the Eruv doesn't have anything to do with the shofar on the Sabbath or the shofar on Yom Kippur. It doesn't allow for it because... And it's not only because it still goes to an expert. There's other places where this is discussed. And it's simply the notion that it's not an instrument that we need for that. And there are other, like the Shabbos itself being the sign, Yom Kippur being the powerful notion of the day to concentrate on, one might take care to, you know, polish it up a little bit. One might take care to try it out once or twice because it's there and it's calling to you as you use it to call to God. You know, there's lots of reasons why people have discussed the kind of separation from these things. It doesn't mean that you've... You know, again, like, you put these things in a context, and I hope I said it the right way. If we want to do the mitzvot more in the rabbinic way and more according to the laws and glean meaning from them, we learn through sometimes doing things one way and then challenging ourselves to do it in different ways. Part of the whole project of the Masechta we're in is to do that, and it's to read through these Shabbos laws. You know, some families have different customs around their Shabbos table, and then they're sitting and learning a Masechet of Gemara. This is an encounter that's much like, and I think I've said this before, much like what the rabbis wanted us to encounter when it came to coming to the shul on the afternoon and hearing them drush the law and kind of providing the backup and the background to it and the verses that go along to create that. So allow me. Rav Abba says the following. V'shabbat chayav adam livtzoa al shtei kikarot. On the Sabbath, a person is required to break bread over two loaves. Dichtiv, and this is about the manna, I think you mentioned before. Lechem Mishneh, for it's written, a double portion was given on Fridays. So the reason why we have two challahs on the table, two loaves of bread on the table for each of the meals, is because it says you've got double portion on the Friday. Amar Rav Ashi, Rav Ashi says, Chazina leila Rav Kahana de nakat tarte uvata chada. I saw that Rav Kahana would hold two loaves when he made the Hamotzi blessing, but he would break, in other words, cut only one of them. Amar laktu kativ. They gathered a double portion, it's written, not they broke a double portion. So, in other words, he was fine. A person says, motzi over two loaves, right? Maybe you've been to a Shabbat house and you've seen this. And then one of the loaves is taken, put on the side a little bit, and one is the loaf that is used. What happens in the practice of making motzi? So goes the Gemara further. Rav Zeira havabata akula sherute. Rav Zeira would break a piece of bread after he made the motzi lesson, large enough what? To last his entire meal. So imagine that he's got two challahs, and he's made the motzi now over his challot, and he breaks a piece of that challah off that in essence is big enough to last the whole meal. Whether or not we're talking about a certain measurement thereof of challah, a kazait, an olive's volk, which is has its certain amount on a scale and its size, or it's just like a big enough piece for the meal, meaning he's going to eat some bread here, and he's going to have enough, and it looks a little bit, you know, like a roll would look. You know, you're not going to just have a roll. It's not a bite of bread. You know, he's talking about a chunk of this loaf. And so Ravina says to Ravashi, Amar le Ravina le Ravashi, v'ha mechaze kira avtanuta. That appears like he's a glutton. You know, that's a over voracious kind of way of breaking the bread. And he, in essence, not only is it over voracious in that it's a big piece, but two, he's just made the bracha and now he's taking a piece as the first act that he does. Could that be a holy way of breaking bread? And so Amarle, so he says to Ravina, Kevan dechayim lo avid v'ha'idna hu deka'avid lo mechaze ke'arav tanuta. Since he doesn't do it like this every day, it's actually not over voracious, and it's actually not achilat gasa, a rude way of eating, and it's not, you know, some kind of animalistic way of breaking bread. It actually is appropriate for the Sabbath, in other words, is the outcome. Now, this gets into halacha l'maaseh. When I have two loaves of bread at my Shabbat table, and I brought some of the other sources that we can read in order to understand where the Gemara is coming out, because this is, in essence, halacha l'maaseh. It's normative halacha today. There's a section of the Shulchan Aruch in Or HaChaim called Dine Bitziat HaPat B'Shabbat, the laws of breaking bread on the Sabbath. Botzeya al shtei kikarot, you should bless over two loaves of bread, parenthesis, shlemot. Some manuscripts have the word full loaves. So in other words, when someone has a piece of a challah left and they use it as their second challah, that's a discussion within the halachic codes already. She'ochez shtehem biado, you should hold both loaves in the hand. Uvotzeya hatachtona, and you actually take the bottom one, so they're imagining that you're holding one challah over the top of another, and you take the bottom one, and you use it to eat. Says the Rabbi Moshe Isserles Ashkenazic gloss on that Rabbi Yosef Karo normative Sephardic opinion in the law code, Aval b'yom ha-shabbat o b'leil yom tov, on Shabbat and Yontif specifically. Now, I want to just make clear we're talking about Yontif and Shabbos instead of just a regular good old motzi at any meal. Botzeya al ha'elyona, you actually take the top challah and use the top challah. V'hatam hu al derech ha'kabbalah. And the reason why you do that is because there's a Kabbalistic reason. Period. So already in the 16th century, he's bringing into the normative code of Jewish law, Litvakish, if you will, not at that point, Polish. He's bringing in the notion that there's a mystical reason why I take the top challah. Mitzvah litzo b'Shabbat prusa gedola. It's a mitzvah to bless on Shabbat on the amount of bread prusa gedola on an amount of bread shetaspik lo lechol asuda, that will be enough for you for the whole meal. Third law. Ein ha-misubin rasha'in lit'om. Your guests cannot take a taste of the bread. Ad she'yit'om ha-botzeya. Until the one making the blessing takes a bite of the bread. So in a traditional kind of way, you would see someone take two chalot, the top one on Shabbat, according to our Ashkenazic ancestor, Rabbi Isserles, is the one who's making the law. You say, after Nitilat Yadayim, because they assume that you read that section of law before, you say, Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz, you take the top one, you put the bottom one aside. There are those who say, even before you got to that point where you're holding two challahs, that you take the knife and you make a little spot where you're going to score it so that you're going to cut there. There are those who say you don't need to do that and that you can rip it, and this is two prevailing Ashkenazic authorities who have an argument about it. Meanwhile, you take the top one, put the other one aside, and you take a piece that's enough for the meal, or you cut a piece that's enough for the meal, and you dip it in salt, or you sprinkle salt on it, again, depending on your custom with salt, and if it's within 1 year of having a bride and groom around you, the minhag is to use honey. And for all through the beginning of the year, Rosh Hashanah till Shmini Atzeret, you can use honey, if that's your custom. But meanwhile, you take the salt, and then you actually, if you're the one making the motzi, you actually take that piece, and you take a bite. And then you start to distribute the bread. And that is the codific way of doing this. Why the top one and not the bottom? Well, according to the Kabbalah, I have a reason. Hatachtonah. Here's the note about the Tachtonah. There's a little legal commentary. The Bach Katab Litzoa Ala Elyonah, but the Bach, who's a authority, says, take the top one, the Ein Ma'avirin Ala Mitzvot, that you shouldn't say to the top challah, you know what, you were in a place to do a mitzvah of being the bread that was blessed, but now I'm going to take the bottom one. You have to be, you know, right and do the mitzvah that's in your hand, and you, of course, see the top one before you see the bottom one. V'taz katav, v'ani nahagti, I had the custom, k'she mivarachin ala tachtona, when I bless over the bottom one, maniach ani ota karov ela yoter ma'elyona. So if I was going to use the bottom one, and because, like the code of law told me, I move the bottom one a little bit so that the bottom one kind of sticks out and the top one's here. So that the bottom one is actually closer to me. So that when I take it, I do this kind of... Okay, so that's one kind of halachic discussion that goes. But this reason why we use top, bottom, where we put things left, right, that is kind of a whole throw back to what? The showbread. And he says, according to the Kabbalah, and one of the glosses in here is the person who gives you the sources as to where Rabbi Moshe Isserles is learning. And if we thought Rabbi Moshe Isserles was just, you know, the good accountant type of legal code expert, unlike Yosef Karo, who we know is a mystic and had lots of angels bring him to all kinds of palaces up in the heavens, and he writes books like this, as much as he's a rationalist lawyer, he is a way out there mystic and has beautiful, beautiful tales of Jewish mysticism. Isserles also dealt with Kabbalistic books that were coming out of Sfat at the time, and that were coming out of Provence and France at the time. And the showbread is the exact reason of why they're talking about bread at all at a Sabbath table. This is a book called Sha'ar Kavanot. It's one of the Arizal's books, the Rabbeinu Yitzhak Luria, the great Sfat Kabbalist. And he says about the challahs of Shabbat, she'zisigulah, It's a, how would I translate sigula? It's a kind of a beautiful, beautiful act, and it's and it can be a good sign for you. In Yelecha Yud Bet Kikar, if there will be 12 breads on your table, Kmo Lechem Hapani, like the show breads that were in the Beit HaMikdash. And he has little diagrams as to how to arrange 12 little loaves on the table. Two of them being in front of you for the ones you're going to break, and these other breads out there. He says, but if you're not going to have all 12, as I'm explaining, and I imagine what he's doing is, in a mystical way, giving us this imaginative reality that our table is like an altar, and we can see that we're arranging, in essence, through having these two loaves, the reminder that it's 2 plus 10, because he does get into the whole use of imagination and Dimayon in several of his passages where he kind of hints that the things I say, you don't actually have to do. Part of Kabbalistic literature. He says about the bread themselves, min alechem, from the bread, hayimini, the one on the right. So here he's like completely taking it to the fact that I can now have one on the right and left, which some people who follow Kabbalistic tradition do, which completely brings the bottom and the top discussion over in this code, you know, to a different place, saying, wait a minute, do I have a different tradition? Are there people who do right and left? That Shehu keneged o yud shel havaya, shem havaya. That is like, the one on the right is like a yud in the name of God. And vahu keneged a chachma, and that's related to the wisdom of what he's learning out, the spherotic chart. There are 10 different aspects of God's character that the mystics basically use, that's called Lurianic Kabbalah. And one of them is called the sphera, the aspect of wisdom. And when I break my bread, the one on the right reminds me of the ever-flowing wisdom that's coming down from the heavens. As in what? The man that came to us on Fridays. And we had a double portion there. So I better have at least two. If you're not going to have 12, have at least two. So he gets you back to, you could have been asked to have 12, to link directly to the experience of the Beit HaMikdash.
Seeing that bread is godlike.
He is saying that bread is like the man and has a godly quality.
I was actually, when earlier you were reading about bread being, taking us back to the Garden of Eden, I actually, after you started getting into the whole discussion that the bread is a phallus and now you got the knife and you're going to cut it, it started sounding to me like the whole covenant.
The covenant piece.
But
it is in a certain sense, but it's the flowing wisdom, according to this interpretation, that leads to the reality of nourishment, which is, in God's wisdom, the whole creation, but the partnership that we need to take nourishment out. And if there's anything of symbolism in that knife that's about circumcision and the covenant, that which is really an interesting twist on the whole discussion within the narrative that comes out of the narrative of the law, here's where it really is, that God will provide. God is the provider. It gets you back to that fundamental idea of the Sabbath being about God's provision. And so where Gemara went is to the normative law that you have two loaves. Where the normative rationalist lawyers went was about how you actually break the bread and who does it first. And they mention the mystical commentary of Isaac Luria, who gives you all kinds of connections to the world of the temple and the flowing divine presence in the world through the different way he understands godly shefa, effluence, back to the very two straightforward loaves, back to the Torah itself, to say that's why we still to this day have two challahs on our table for every meal. Let's go.
This is what happened when they had a